Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund-level intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's good to be with you.
Glad to be here.
It looks like we got a lot to cover today. So what are we going to be talking about?
Yeah, we do have a packed call, but we'll run through some of the macroeconomic releases that caught our attention over the last couple of weeks, as well as its REIT earnings, or its earnings season, and the REITs are reporting. And we have a number of REIT calls and really results that jumped out at us and we wanted to highlight for you. And then we'll, of course, touch on the upcoming events and the macro calendar to highlight a number of the releases that we will be watching. So, Cole, do you want to kick it off with the macro releases?
Excellent. Yeah, I'd love to get us started. I think the big topic last week was about labor data. And so we got a number of important releases that I think shed some light on the economy. But the first one was the job openings and labor turnover survey. So this is a Bureau of Labor Statistics release. It was on July 30th. And I think the important thing to mention here was that very little changed on the month across a number of metrics. So little to no change in job openings from the previous month. It came in at a level of 8.2 million. Number of hires decreased a little bit from 5.3 million to 5.1 million over the month as well. And the number of separations changed very little at 5.1 million. So not a lot changed on the months, but I think if you pay attention to the annual rate of change, you can see what the Federal Reserve is probably looking at to indicate a cooling labor market. So annual rates of change are down quite a bit. Job openings down 10.3%, hires down 9.4%, and quits down 12.5%. So fewer jobs open for folks, fewer people leaving their current jobs, and fewer folks getting hired. So definitely a sign of a cooling labor market relative to where we were a year ago. It's definitely being closely watched by the Fed and investors. It's certainly evidence that the Fed will need to support a rate cut. And, you know, everybody in the CRE industry is certainly waiting for that. But on a closer CRE-related note, we also got construction spending data. So this is U.S. Census Bureau data estimates, and they released that on August 1st. So the total construction value put in place, this is given at a seasonally adjusted annual rate, slowed on the month, down 0.3%. but also down on the year 0.4%. So it's now at a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 2.1 trillion. But if you break this out, they also very nicely put together the non-residential construction value put in place figures. So that's inclusive of a bunch of different sectors, but office, commercial, and lodging are some of the breakouts that they do. Spending on all of the non-residential private sector value put in place fell 0.5%, 0.15% month over month to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of $736 billion. So it's still up a little bit on the year. Mind you, this is given in a raw dollar amount. So you want to see if this is outpacing or underpacing the rate of inflation. And it is up 4.2%, so outpacing inflation a little bit. And that's up from June 2023. But this is the lowest annual growth rate since October of 2021. If you look at this chart, you'll see that it continues to kind of go down each month. There was only one month that was an exception to the trend over the last really year and a half, and that was in 2024, early 2024. But lowest annual growth rate since October of 2021. So construction is slowing down a little bit. But Omar, the data we got the very same day or one day before the Federal Reserve met, do you want to tell us a little bit about their rate decision?
Sure. So on July 31st, the Federal Reserve released its policy statement holding the target range for the federal funds rate at 5.25% to 5.5%. And this is following the FOMC's late July meeting. This was not a surprise. This is very much in line with the market's expectations going into this announcement. The markets were expecting no change at this meeting, but the FOMC statement and the subsequent Fed chair's press conference indicated that while progress has been made to tame inflation, it still remains above the target range. So there's still a ways to go. And while there are signs of softening in the labor market that Cole was just talking about, Chair Powell did point out that there's also continued strength in the overall economy. And so I don't think he was patting himself on the back quite yet, but was, you know, doing what economists do best of on one hand, on the other. And ultimately, in the press conference and nor in the statement were any hard or strict commitments made to really the magnitude or the timing of monetary easing or the anticipated rate cuts. That being said, the markets really interpreted this as we're making progress towards the really inflation goals. We're seeing the softening that's there, and the markets started pricing in, you know, with certainty that there will be a rate cut starting in September. During the press conference, that was, I would say, kind of confirmed, but then shortly after, on the release of additional data, that those jumped around a bit. So, Cole, what was some of that data that was released shortly after, and how'd that move those rate cut expectations?
Yeah, I think the timing is quite interesting for this one, right? You had the press conference on the 31st, and then you actually got the release of the employment situation on Friday. So it complicates the picture a little bit, but and maybe the story would have been different had this come out a week earlier, but the BLS released the June employment situation on August 2nd. That was just this past Friday. And it showed that the economy gained 114,000 jobs. These were driven by healthcare, construction, and transportation, which I thought at least the last two sectors are interesting because they can be leading indicators of the economy. But there were losses in the information and technology sectors. I don't think that was a surprise to too many. But the big surprise with the overall release was that this was a huge, huge miss in terms of expectations for monthly job growth. There was a Bloomberg survey of economists. They coalesced around the idea of possibly 175,000 new jobs added. So 114,000 is quite a bit below that. They also revised the previous 2 months downward by a cumulative 29,000 jobs. So much lower than we saw in the last 2 months as well. So in May and April. And like you said, the Fed views the softening labor market as a sign that it can begin to cut interest rates. Maybe it would have been a different story had we received this prior to the meeting from the 30th and the 31st. But if you take a look at the CME FedWatch tool, or you did shortly thereafter the release of the data, markets started pricing in a 75% chance of a 50 basis point cut in September, which shot up quite a bit on the day. Previously, like you said, they were only pricing in one 25 basis point cut in September and possibly two by the next meeting. But chances of a 50 basis point cut lurched on the news of really weak job gains. So some interesting stuff there. I think noting some other recent events could be another interesting week in terms of expectations for September. But we're talking about the markets here. So I'm going to turn it back over to you because I think we're going to talk a little bit more about what some of the players in public real estate investment vehicles are saying about the economy, maybe their expectations for rate cuts. What sector do you want to start with and what company were you looking at?
Yeah, we can jump into industrial. I listened to the Prologis call. Prologis really kicked off the REIT earnings. So on July 17th, they reported and had their investor call. And the company reported second quarter results that were mostly in line with analyst expectations. And while the company missed on EBITDA, it met expectations on FFO per share. And regarding their portfolio and the operating metrics for the quarter, management reported that the global occupancy across their portfolio reached 96.5, which was really led by a significantly stronger U.S. portion of their portfolio. However, they also did note that effective market rents are starting to soften a bit. And they've dropped about 2% during the second quarter. And that was largely driven by their Southern California properties. The Prologis management team mentioned on the call that they anticipate soft market conditions over the next year. So I thought that that was an interesting kind of turn of industrial's been really a hot commodity amongst the real estate sectors for a long time. And so some of this cautionary wording from arguably one of the largest players in this space might be something to watch going forward. And I know you tuned into another big industrial REIT. What were you hearing?
Yeah, I think the one I looked at was Rexford Industrial Realty. They are a Southern California-based REIT, so they offer some really interesting commentary on the markets that I think Prologis is concerned about. So they released their earnings on July 18th, so just one day after. And this was an all-around beat. So on revenue, on earnings, on FFO. But what's really interesting is that they had NOI was up 21% that this quarter or the past quarter. FFO per share was up 11%, and their operating margins actually increased to 77.7%. What's interesting about Rexford is that even though they are in the Southern California market, and you've seen some worry there about rent growth, the types of properties that they own are quite different. They are infill properties, smaller. I think the average size is fairly low for a tenant relative to some of the other industrial players that we've seen sign big leases in the Southern California market. And so they operate in kind of a different space than Prologis does, despite being in one of the same markets. So they are facing rising vacancy and negative absorption in parts of the Southern California market. They continued to cite things like high interest rates and global unrest impacting demand for some of these infill markets. And I know that Southern California has experienced some problems. You've seen a lot of importing kind of shift over to the East Coast, where some of those labor agreements had taken a long time to work out in Los Angeles, but still Rexford doing quite well. They adjusted full year guidance for FFO downward, though, due to expectations for some rise in costs. And I know we'll get down the list here, but that's a pretty common theme, I think, among most of the calls we listen to outside even industrial. But silver lining there, Rexford is pretty hungry for acquisitions. They say they have $2 billion in liquidity. They signaled on the call that they have an appetite for more acquisitions in the second half. They made some splashy headlines in the first and second quarter with some big acquisitions of some portfolios in the Southern California market. I expect from their commentary that you might see a few more in the second half, but definitely worth paying attention to those two calls. I think they shed a different light on some of the things going on in the biggest industrial market, one of the biggest industrial markets in the U.S., which is Southern California. I think our next sector, you covered an office call. SL Green is a big New York-based office REIT. What was going on there?
Yeah, so jumping from kind of the LA area over to the East Coast in New York. So on July 18th, SL Green held its earning call with investors and analysts. It's Manhattan's largest office landlord, and they reported positive operating results for the second quarter. It was really a big beat on the top line or revenue for Q2, which really translated into a beat on earnings and FFO per share for the quarter. On the call, the management team for this New York focused office REIT reported some impressive rent growth through the second quarter, which was really helped and boosted by tourism in New York City. But the team also mentioned that they continued to experience some challenges with their leasing activity, particularly in their Midtown South properties. The company continues its efforts and a pretty extensive capital improvement plan across their portfolio, where they're fitting out properties with better amenities and features to make the space more attractive and trying to bring new tenants in. But the guidance and the tone on the call really suggested that even possibly after this extensive work, that there will still be headwinds existing, and that's something that I feel as though the conversation around office and the future of office has already been going on for a number of years, and I think it still has probably a number more years to go. But the management noted that the company has a growing special servicing and asset management segment, which I guess I think that's excellent for the company. But taking a little bit of a, you know, cynic view, that kind of confirms that there are headwinds in this space. But maybe this is something that can help the company really kind of mitigate the challenges. And I think maybe turn some of these situations around. However, in terms of growth, so moving away from kind of the any sort of skepticism, in New York, the company, the leadership noted that they are shifting greater focus to their East Midtown properties, while also really hinting at a possibility of new joint ventures in foreign markets. And they mentioned that these could be anticipated in the coming years. And this is something that I think is, even though this was a pretty kind of brief mention on the call, I thought it was quite notable because this company has been very much focused on New York, and it's hyper-focused there, that opening up this joint venture route and in foreign markets, I think could be really exciting and potentially change the strategy for the company. But I wasn't the only one listening to, you know, an office REIT call. Cole, what were you hearing?
I did want to piggyback off something you said first. You mentioned tourism as kind of a boon to SL Green, and they probably, among other things, very well known for owning One Vanderbilt right next to New York's Grand Central Station. And much like Empire State Realty Trust, they get a not insignificant portion of revenue from their observatories on some of their big New York skyscrapers. So I think that's pretty interesting stuff and something you don't see with a lot of office REITs outside of New York. One of which I looked at, actually, and this is Cousins Properties. And Cousins is an Atlanta-based Sunbelt office REIT. So they own in a lot of the major markets that have seen some serious growth in population over the last couple of years, certainly post-COVID. So we're talking Atlanta, Dallas, Houston, Austin. And they own now more than 20 million square feet across those markets. A rather large chunk of these are in Atlanta, so in their home market. 14 buildings in that particular one. But they released their earnings on the 25th of July. They actually missed on earnings, but they beat on FFO, and they actually saw a surprise miss on net income. These, to some analysts, were stronger than expected results. The FFO measure in particular, that was well above consensus estimates. But Cousins did see an impressive 18.2% rent spread on the space that they leased in quarter two. So that was more than 300,000 square feet. Their strongest markets they mentioned on the call were Nashville, Austin, and Atlanta. Phoenix actually saw some negative office absorption, which I thought was interesting. When they called out their home market, Atlanta, they have 88% of their space is actually leased. And they paired that with some JLL data that suggested that the overall vacancy rate for office in Atlanta the overall occupancy rate for office in Atlanta is much lower. So they own a different subset of properties that have much different sort of demand drivers. So Cousins specializes in what they call lifestyle office. And these are sort of highly amenitized spaces, class A office in maybe not necessarily central business districts, but a lot of these kind of edge cities or suburban downtowns that are much closer to where the heads of office or a lot of their executives live. So this is quite interesting because they are benefiting from this flight to quality that I think has become actually a problem in some other markets where there's not supply to why too. And so another thing that was really interesting about Cousins that's certainly different from what you would find in any of these New York-based REITs or more urban office space is that they get a significant portion of their revenue from parking. And so as the return to office has kind of accelerated in markets like Atlanta and Austin and Houston, Dallas, they've actually seen a relatively big boost in revenue there. And if I remember correctly, they actually said that in their quarter one call as well when I paid attention to that. But office, definitely one that's worth paying attention to. A sector that I think has surprised people as the next one we're going to talk about, and that's retail. So I think I covered one here that is near and dear to my heart. I like Brixmor Property Group. I worked there for a period of time, and they released their earnings on July 30th. They saw a beat on earnings and FFO, but they missed on revenue. So I think that speaks to some of the challenges these REITs are seeing with expenses. They're New York-based, but they own in a number of markets. They're concentrated in suburban areas of Florida, Pennsylvania, Georgia. So in the Orlando area, Atlanta area, and in addition to the Philly area. They have cemented their position as one of the leading grocery-anchored retailers. They acquired some new properties in the coastal southeast. So in Hilton Head, South Carolina, it's one that they picked up. They also announced more than $100 million in pre-leased redevelopment projects. They have reinvested a lot in the second quarter, more than $37 million. They've delivered 9% plus return. They've planned more than $200 million for the full year. And they're definitely interested in these value-add properties in their existing markets. They have a lot of weaker legacy tenants that are still paying rent, but they would like to replace them to capture some of those rent spreads. One of the companies called out on the call was Big Lots. They're hoping to recapture a lot of those boxes and replace them with higher paying tenants. And they mentioned also that they don't anticipate any negative impacts from the kind of ongoing merger case of Kroger and Albertsons. They also mentioned on the call they achieved record occupancy and renewal spreads in the second quarter. They have seen a same-store NOI growth of 5.5%. They actually raised their NOI forecasts. But one kind of negative aspect to this call that I would say, and I'm correcting myself from earlier, they missed on revenue, so the expenses were not really mentioned, but they do expect to see a lot of uncollectible debt in the second half of 2024. So that was kind of their headline negative item. But Omar, you actually listened to a little bit of a different retail call. What can you tell us about Agree?
Yeah, so on July 24th, Agree Realty Corp, which is a retail-focused net lease REIT, it has about a $7 billion market cap. They reported better-than-expected earnings for Q2. I'm hearing there's a little bit of a thread or a commonality of the retail REITs posting some pretty strong numbers. But Agree is a Royal Oak, Michigan-based firm. They provided favorable full year 2024 adjusted FFO guidance of between $4.11 to $4.14 per share, which is up about 4 to 4.8% from 2023's adjusted FFO per share. And the company was really clearly in acquisition mode through the last quarter, having invested about $203 million across 70 retail net lease properties, wow. Which were spread across 37 states. And the properties acquired had a weighted average cap rate of 7.7%. Going in cap rate, that's about 90 basis points higher from their going in cap rate a year prior. And the company's expected to stay acquisitive because they also increased their acquisition guidance for the year. So this is guidance for full year 2024. They said it on the earnings call for the second quarter results. They upped it to $700 million for the year, which is up from $600 million for the year, or that's about a 17% increase. So very, very acquisitive. And while the company did report really a very strong beat for the second quarter, on the call, management noted that they were seeing some weakness in the lower end consumer segments across their portfolio, which of course could be a drag on future demand and overall performance operating metrics. And therefore, it could be a potential headwind in quarters to come. And while the REIT is moving away from pharmacies such as Walgreens and CVS, they actually used the term like peak CVS on the call, which I thought was interesting. They noted that they are increasingly focused on regional large format convenience stores or C stores, which are expanding into new territories. This includes regional players like Wawa, Sheetz, Quick Trip, and Maverik. And I thought that, you know, this got a bit of attention on the call, not only because, you know, it has big strategic implications for the firm and they're ultimately the investors, but also because the company had released a pretty interesting and more detailed kind of like thesis or white paper on their site, you know, maybe a week before. And it really breaks down kind of the why these large format C stores are so attractive. And I would encourage folks to, you know, it's worth flipping through and definitely a good read. If you didn't listen to the old call, you know, I thought it was an interesting thesis to see really kind of like articulated. But the retail sector seems to be doing quite well, even though I am hearing some concerns and some commonalities across the calls around some slowing down. But I think we heard some of that as well in other sectors. So what were you hearing in for multifamily or apartments or broadly residential?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting, and this will probably pair well with the next one we looked at too, that, you know, Agree and Brixmor are two very different companies, but they both indicate that they're concerned about sort of the lower end consumer portion of their retail. So I think that's worth mentioning, but kind of similar to one of the other ones we talked about in the multifamily and apartment sector, which is what we looked at next, I took a look at Equity Residential. A lot of folks who listen in are probably familiar with Equity. They're a Chicago-based REIT that develops, acquires, owns, and operates multifamily in basically your gateway dynamic metro areas. So think New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, you know, really your top 10 to 20 dynamic metros here in the U.S. Company was actually founded by Sam Zell, who's an industry titan, but he did sadly pass away last year. That was actually mentioned on the call because this is kind of their one of the very first quarters that he was not really at the helm or his so other folks have taken charge. But they released their earnings on the 29th of July. They beat on earnings per share. They beat on FFO, but they missed on revenue, which is actually something we've seen a handful of times here. But in the second quarter, they saw same store revenues increase by 2.9%. They saw NOI growth of 3%. And NFFO per share rose 3.2% due to high demand and very limited supply for their specific type of properties in coastal markets. So they remain pretty focused on acquiring recently built properties in their expansion markets, and they're underwriting a 5% cap rate. So renewal rate increases in the second quarter for their existing properties were pretty stable at 4.5%. They have solid application volumes for all types of units. Their occupancy improved in the second quarter. So they were up to 96.2% from 95.9%. And I mentioned this briefly before, but they are seeing some supply pressure in specific submarkets. But they, and I think that this is definitely something that was called out on most, if not all, of the apartment REIT calls, but there have been some major supply pressures in certain markets, but Equity doesn't seem to be too concerned with these because a lot of the new supply doesn't really match their type of property. So they don't really do these sort of garden style or sort of Texas donut type properties. They have a very specific type of kind of well-amenitized, high-income focused apartments. And they also highlighted a number of other things in their call. They still have a fairly aggressive investment strategy. They acquired 800 plus new units across kind of the Dallas, Atlanta, Boston, and Denver markets. They did sell two properties, and I thought this was interesting. They contained 300 plus units. One of those buildings was in Washington, and another was in San Francisco. And I think that those have been markets that there's been some concerns about. And both are interestingly tied to the tech sector pretty heavily as well. Equity is very worried about expenses. They are putting in place some prop tech solutions They instituted a new AI chatbot that they claim can assist up to 75% of different resident requests. So they can kind of slim down labor costs on some of those items. But really, really interesting kind of subset of the apartment sector. Now, I think you looked at one that's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, not to be confused with Equity Residential. You looked at Equity Lifestyle Properties. I'd never heard of this company before, so I'm interested to hear you talk a little bit about what was in that call.
Well, similar roots in the sense that both they're Chicago-based. They're both have the same founder of this is another Sam Zell company, but the focus is, you know, quite different. So Equity Lifestyle Properties held their call on the 23rd of July, and they are a very large owner and operator of manufactured homes, RV parks, and marinas. The REIT, which has a portfolio of more than 450 properties across the U.S. and a market cap of more than $14 billion, reported better than expected results for the second quarter. And this was driven by a quite solid 6.4% increase in NOI for the first half of 2024 compared to the same period in 2023. And while the company had lower than expected operating expenses for the quarter, which usually would be is very much a good thing, these were largely offset by a slower quarter in their RV segment of their portfolio. And this was partially due to bad weather interrupting guest stays and really reducing the demand for RV sites. However, on the call, management did note that the tight housing market continues to be quite supportive of the manufactured home segment, which represents about 2/3 of the company's total revenues. And that segment has maintained a 95% occupancy rate through the second quarter. And to illustrate the point of really how the tight housing market is supportive of manufacturing home portion of their portfolio, the management really had the comparison of a new single family home today cost about $500,000. And then a new manufactured home cost about $100,000. So it's really a fraction of the cost. Plus, there's still quite good, I would say, reception amongst the senior generation and the senior demographic. And while, you know, I think this is an interesting company to watch, because even though it's not really the most, you know, RV parks, manufactured homes, and marinas are really not the most traditional of commercial real estate sectors or property types or whatever you want to call it, it really is a kind of a fascinating portion and I think it's very rich with context, right, to monitor what's happening in these spaces, because these are, I would say, generally much more budget conscious users. And whether you're looking at manufactured housing as being a kind of a substitute for single family homes or for other types of kind of, you know, I would say more expensive living, the RV sites are also a good, you know, cheaper alternative for a lot of the travel and leisure that we might see in hospitality. So interesting company to watch, particularly around, if, you know, we've brought up a number of times because they've been mentioned on so many of these calls, that if there is a shift in kind of consumer preferences, or consumers are really kind of clamping down on, you know, tightening their belts and being a bit more budget conscious, this will be a good company to see how that flows through their portfolio.
Yeah, but potentially an interesting hedge against kind of the hospitality sector against the consumer. If the demand is still there for travel, might be worth paying attention to.
Totally. I think it's, you know, they're on the same spectrum, but ultimately a bit probably sitting on different sides of the center.
Absolutely.
You were looking at self-storage.
Yeah, and we like to pair self-storage and multifamily together for a number of reasons. I think, for one, the two markets are just simply tied closer together. You know, if the single-family home market remains relatively dampened and, you know, people have a lot of stuff, and so they would rather pair together an apartment with a self-storage unit, so the markets can run together, similar seasonality. But the other thing is that they have similar kind of lease structures, right? You sign for a year, You have fairly interesting turnover. And so I think this is worth paying attention to because you get a really good idea of what's going on with the consumer and, you know, how different segments of the market are reacting to housing. And so I took a look at Public Storage. Public Storage is based in Glendale, California, and they have more than 3,000 locations. They've actually been in the S&P 500 for about 20 years. It's a fairly old company. They were formed in 1972, and they're actually credited more or less with helping popularize self-storage as an institutional investment. I didn't know too much about Public Storage before joining this industry. I certainly had heard of them before, and I think that is one of the reasons why. It's definitely a very well-known self-storage chain. They announced their earnings on July 30th. They had great results. They beat on earnings, funds from operation, and revenue. And they exceeded analyst expectations on occupancy, which I think was a big concern at the start of the year because there's been a lot of new supply. So occupancy was 93% in the second quarter compared with analyst expectations for the second quarter of 92.7%. So they beat on expectations there. But there were some kind of mixed parts of this call. Move-in rents or, you know, initial asking rents have fallen quite a bit, 14%. And like I mentioned, that large competitive set has come online. There's a lot of other big players in this space, one of which you're going to tell us about next. But same store revenues fell a little bit at 1%, even if the overall revenue of the portfolio was a bit better than expected. The company owns what they call a high growth pool. That is 22% of their portfolio by square footage. But they saw 50% non-same store NOI growth in that kind of almost quarter of their portfolio. 70% of new leases that are being signed, Public Storage, are completed digitally. So you don't have to go into their office to sign a new lease. Companies cut down significantly on labor costs. I asked my family who recently signed a lease at a self-storage facility at what step in the process they ever had to pay attention to an actual human being. And it was a very, very small amount of time just simply to pick up the lock. So I think that these self-storage companies gotten pretty creative about cutting expenses. Public Storage, though, they have adjusted their full-year guidance as market conditions have become a little bit more competitive. So they revised those downward. So one of the other big players is one I know you paid attention to, and that's Extra Space. They made a lot of headlines recently. What'd you see with them?
Yeah, so Extra Space reported on July 31st. They're a Salt Lake City, Utah-based self-storage REIT. You mentioned they're massive, right? They have over 2,300 properties across the U.S., and this is covering 1.6 million storage units. And I know they definitely got quite a few headlines when they acquired a rival firm, which was Life Storage, late last year. But I would say this quarter, if there were headlines, it probably said that they, missed, right? So they reported weaker than expected earnings for the second quarter. And although FFO per share was slightly higher than consensus, still overall, it was, they missed on many of the line items that did matter. And so occupancy across their portfolio increased in the second quarter by more than one percentage point over the first quarter. And it was up by 30 basis points on the year. Now, looking at occupancy a little bit deeper, same store occupancy rose to 94.3% for the Extra Space storage portion of the portfolio and 93.8% for the Life Storage portion of their portfolio. Now, this increase contributed to slightly higher revenue in the quarter, but the company noted a weakening consumer financial situation, which is eroding the pricing power and which management on the call cautioned could continue to be a headwind for future results if it continues or worsens. During the call, management also noted the negative impact of the tight housing market, as Cole, you were speaking to as well, because move-ins and move-outs, moves are good for the self-storage demand, right? And so with fewer home purchases, fewer moves, that ultimately translates to less demand for self-storage. And finally, the company mentioned that it is shifting its geographic focus and footprint strategy a bit, reducing its presence in California and focusing more on the Sun Belt states. And I think we were to our last property sector, so we would be, I think, remiss if we did not touch on hospitality, a very hot, I'd say, sector, probably one of the hotter ones over the last 12 months. I tuned into Pebblebrook Hotel Trust, so they shared their second quarter earnings results on July 25th, and Pebblebrook reported results that really beat consensus expectations up and down the board. The company reported a very big, it was actually, you know, 64% over the mean consensus estimate. So a big beat on earnings for the second quarter. And also, you know, a notable beat on the mean consensus estimate for FFO for the quarter. Now, this is a Bethesda, Maryland-based company, which owns about 46 hotel properties. And they raised their, not only did they have excellent second quarter results, but they also raised their full year 2024 EBITDA and FFO guidance by approximately 17 and 11%. Percent respectively, and that's compared to the 2023 EBITDA and FFO. And the company's management mentioned on the call that they have seen strong performance in the urban hotel properties within their portfolio, which not only have seen strong demand from tourism and, you know, I would say the resurgence of travel, or the, you know, I think we're probably at the tail end of revenge travel, but they've also benefited, this urban portion of their portfolio has also benefited from quite tight pipelines, limited new deliveries, and really just kind of they've benefited from really tight supply within the local markets that they operate in. And while the second quarter results were very strong, the company's management raised cautious tone, I would say, on expected weaker RevPAR for the coming quarters. And this is going to be particularly driven by softer ADR growth. So even though, you know, the occupancy's there, the rates are coming down. And they cited economic uncertainty and an increasingly price conscious leisure consumer. And management on this, they lowered their full year 2024 RevPAR growth guidance to 1.25 to 2.25% the full year. Given their competitive position in the market and just how their portfolio is located across, you know, the U.S. and in these urban centers, I think that this warning or this caution is something certainly worth noting and paying attention to, because we're hearing this from all this, from multiple sectors, this caution around, you know, a slowing consumer, or, you know, a consumer that's becoming much more price conscious, and therefore it's having implications on things like travel. And Cole, I know you tuned into another hotel REIT or hospitality REIT. What were you hearing? Similar things? What were you hearing?
I was hearing eerily similar things. These are very, very similar companies. I paid attention to Summit Hotel Properties. They're an Austin, Texas-based REIT. They have more than 14,000 rooms across 96 properties, so around double the size of Pebblebrook, but almost all of these hotels are branded Marriotts, with a few Hiltons and Hyatts. Summit released their earnings on 7/29, so July 29th. And this was, again, like you mentioned with that last one, all around beat. So on earnings, on FFO, on revenue. So Summit's ticker, I think, is kind of cute. It's IN, I spelled I-N-N. And they posted a very strong quarter two performance. FFO increased 10% year on year. The company also posted a record for EBITDA. However, they did lower their full year guidance for RevPAR, just like the call you listened to. They're expecting softer demand in the second half of 2024. They have a few lagging markets, or they're in a few lagging markets. That's New Orleans and San Francisco. But that performance is made up by strong RevPAR growth in Dallas, Orlando, Charlotte, and Houston. And if you know anything about those markets and you paid attention to this call, it's because Summit actually has a lot of airport-adjacent hotels. And so a lot of the kind of travel disasters that happened throughout the second quarter were a huge boost to their portfolio and for revenue per available room for the quarter. And so they actually mentioned on the call that sometimes their portfolio isn't directly tied to kind of consumer habit, because you're not necessarily staying at an airport hotel to travel somewhere, but you are at the mercy of the airline and what hotel they pick for you if you're stranded overnight. And so they own a lot of these properties near the major southeastern airports. So Dallas, Orlando, Charlotte being some of the big ones. But I thought that was a really interesting call, because the silver lining in this one was not tied to outlook for the consumer. It was tied to sort of the airlines screwing up. So that was it was a really, really interesting call. I'll want to pay attention to in the future. But we've covered a lot of sectors. I think we've gone through six of them. There are many more niche sectors that you could pay attention to in the REITs. So I know that there's a nice schedule of them upcoming. So do you want to run through some of the data releases and earnings calls that folks could pay attention to after they listen to the podcast?
Sure. I mean, by the time the podcast comes out, I think Simon Property Group will have reported, as well as Vornado Realty Income Corporation, which recently made some news, as well as American Hotel Income Properties, Hudson Pacific Properties, Equinix, which very hot, one of two in the burgeoning sector of data centers. Then you have Americold, Lamar Advertising, which that is... speak about niche, and Medical Properties Trust, right? So this is just a few that are coming up over the following week, and will probably be out or reporting on the day that you hear this recording.
Yeah, and we got a few data releases next week, but one I'll be paying attention to is Thursday, August 8th, so probably the day that the podcast comes out. That's wholesale inventories, so I think folks are really going to be paying attention to that to get an idea of what's going on in the economy. But Omar, I think that is all the time we have today. Been a nice long episode. But before we sign off, I did want to share with our listeners how they might be able to give us some feedback on the show. If you want to leave us a message or feedback via voice recording, we've got a new service to do that. So please check out the show notes, where you will find a link to do so. I'd also encourage folks to rate and comment on the show the old-fashioned way, which is on your preferred podcast platform. Feel free to leave us a like or a comment on the show, or just feel free to send us an email. We have the altusresearch@altusgroup.com email address, and we would certainly love to hear from you. Tell us what topics you'd like on the show, what topics you don't want on the show, or anything else. But in the meantime, Omar, it's been a real pleasure. Had a nice episode today, and I look forward to speaking with you on another one soon. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast, powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.